This week on the Allegheny Front, we're looking back at our best stories from 2018, like how fracking is impacting archaeological sites.
Even if it's recorded with the state, you could bulldoze it away if you wanted to.
And the problem with recycling plastic.
I've changed my life to support recycling, and now it's all been for naught.
I'm Carol Holsapple. We're looking back at stories that taught us something new or made us think differently about the environment and sometimes inspired us, like community members speaking up for clean water.
We are the people and we want to maintain what is rightfully ours.
That's all coming up on the best stories of the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Before we get to our best stories from 2018, some news. After numerous delays and problems, the controversial Mariner East 2 pipeline is officially in service. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more.
Running 350 miles across southern Pennsylvania, the pipeline is now moving ethane, butane, and propane from western Pennsylvania to the Marcus Hook Industrial Complex outside Philadelphia, where they're exported for use in European plastics manufacturing. Energy Transfer Partners, the company building the pipeline, initially estimated the project would cost $2.5 billion. It has faced numerous problems and delays. The Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission temporarily halted construction earlier this year after sinkholes opened in a residential neighborhood in Chester County. The county's district attorney recently opened a criminal investigation into the matter. Construction began in early 2017, and the project was already 18 months behind schedule when it missed a September startup target for bringing the pipeline into service. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
So our first story of favorites from 2018 comes from the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant, and it's about an industry that's been growing in Pennsylvania, hog farming. 2018 was a record year for the number of hogs produced in the state. But for some communities, this hasn't been good news. Julie reported from one small town where residents were trying to keep a new hog farm out.
When Alan Houck retired last year, he moved back to his grandparents' farm in the hills of Todd Township in Huntington County.
When I was a kid, we had cattle here, chickens and pigs. We had a big garden. We raised our food for wintertime here. It's always been beautiful.
Most farms here are still small, 100, maybe 150 cows. But Houck's neighbor has built a factory-sized turkey barn that houses thousands of birds. The manure gets piled up outside.
Sometimes the smell gets so strong it just grabs my throat and makes it hard to breathe.
The turkey barn looks like a large supermarket in the fields. It's by far the biggest structure in this small valley of rolling hills, hiking trails, and campgrounds. But not for long. Construction is starting on another large new barn. This one will house 4,800 hogs at a time. It's being built by Aaron Warner, the brother of the turkey farm owner. The hog manure will be spread on farm fields around the area. Since Alan Houck moved back last year, he's already had to replace his water well because of high bacteria and E. coli. Now he has his tap water tested every few months, so he's confident it's safe as he pours a glass at the kitchen sink.
Tastes good.
But Houck worries that the new hog farm will create more problems for his water. Many in this community of fewer than 1,000 people are concerned the manure will run off the fields or soak into the soil and contaminate their well water. And it's not unfounded.
Oh yeah, you'll definitely end up with more bacteria and higher nutrient levels.
Ryan Mather is a geologist at nearby Juniata College. He says the permeable sandstone soils in Todd Township put groundwater here at risk.
It depends on where your well sits and where the nutrients going, you know, because everything flows downhill. So if you have something that's down gradient and they're putting the stuff up gradient, it's going to get into your water.
There are currently 340 swine CAFOs in Pennsylvania. That stands for Confined Animal Feeding Operations. Russell Redding, Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Agriculture, says their waste is well regulated.
It's a very, very rigorous process.
The state has rules for how CAFOs manage manure. Plus, Redding says there are federal regulations that treat farm waste like pollution from any other industrial facility.
That's a federal requirement, whether you're in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Oklahoma.
State agriculture officials have been looking for ways to make sure Pennsylvania's farmers can be competitive, including growing the pork industry. State programs have already provided $450 million in low-interest loans to expand hog CAFOs in the past few years. Redding says animal farms are getting bigger and more concentrated in part because of demand from consumers and retailers for quality, consistency, and access.
It's one of these trends that I think everybody, even those who are in it, are challenged by to accept that that's the direction we're going because of the capital requirements, because of the intensity of these operations. But I don't believe that that makes them incompatible in a community.
Aaron Warner is on board with this new strategy. He's the farmer building the hog barn in Todd Township. He'll be raising hogs for Country View Family Farms, a Pennsylvania-based corporation that sells things like Italian sausages, barbecue ribs, and bacon across the eastern U.S. Warner did not want to be recorded for this story. In a phone call, he said his family has a right to farm their land and has been surprised by all the controversy. Many residents are worried because their livelihoods depend on Raystown Lake and the natural beauty that bring tourists to the area. Norma Alenovitz owns a campground in the township and the Chuck Wagon, where people order cheesesteaks, homemade pizza, and stromboli from the window and eat outside. It's closed on this sweltering Monday in early July, even though business has been booming.
And the hotter it gets, the more they eat. Because they don't want to cook in their kitchen.
She's worried about odors from the hog farm.
And they congregate out here and they eat out here. So I'm concerned that if there's a lot of smell, they're not going to want to be here and buy my food.
Liberty and justice for all.
Alenovitz is among about 40 residents crammed into a community hall. This night, the three township supervisors are scheduled to vote on an ordinance to ban the hog farm. Todd resident Stephanie Perez reads from the Environmental Rights Amendment to the state constitution.
The people have a right to clean air, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. And we are the people, and we want to maintain what is rightfully ours.
But the state also has a right to farm law, known as Act 38 or ACRES. It limits local ordinances that attempt to regulate agriculture. Todd supervisor Matthew Barnett, who owns a small cattle farm, says the state could sue the township for passing a ban on the hog farm.
Yes, I am very concerned about that because we don't have funds to be in lawsuits.
Barnett says Todd needs its local money for road work and other projects. But when the three supervisors voted...
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Attorney Chad Nicholson of a group called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund helped Todd residents draft this ordinance. He says fights over local control are happening all over the country.
Because this is really about democracy. This is about government. This isn't just about a factory farm. We don't have a factory farm problem. We have a democracy problem in some ways.
Now comes the question. Can Todd Township enforce its ban on the hog farm? The state attorney general's office says it's considering whether to take action. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Since this story aired, the attorney general hasn't taken action, and the case is still pending review. According to sources in Todd Township, the hog farm has started operations, and the pigs have begun arriving.
Thank you.
The global market for recycling plastic has changed dramatically over the last year, and it's already trickling down to what happens with household recycling. That got me thinking about my own recycling habits. If you're like me, the recycling you drag to the curb outside your house for pickup includes cans, sales flyers, soda bottles, yogurt tubs, and the clamshells that raspberries and strawberries are packaged in. I put a lot of those in the blue bin. But that's about to change.
For us, it's business as usual. We're taking everything today that we took last year.
That's Sean Weigel, Program Supervisor of Environmental Services for the City of Pittsburgh. He means the usual glass, paper, metal cans, and plastics with the numbers 1 through 5 and 7 on the container. You know, the number inside the little triangle. But
the numbers, we're going to be probably getting away from those in the near future. They're just, in theory, they work great, but they're very confusing.
That's because not all plastic is created equal. The number on the bottom of that strawberry container is number 1. That's PET, or polyethylene terephthalate. It's also a type of plastic soda and water bottles are made from, but those bottles are a lot more valuable than food containers. Bottles can be cleaned and melted down to make more bottles, or other products like carpets or park benches. That's not what happens to many other shapes and numbers of plastics. Erica Young and I are wearing hard hats and watching a parade of bottles and bags. They're moving on a belt from a pile 3 times our height to a platform where they're sorted by hand.
These bays here below the line are our residue bays. So all of that material in there is going to end up at the landfill.
We're just outside of the tipping floor of Waste Management's MRF, or Materials Recovery Facility, on Neville Island near Pittsburgh. 10,000 tons of material come through here each month. They have recycling contracts with businesses and municipalities in the region. Workers pick out stuff that could hurt the machines, materials that can't be recycled, like garden hoses. We even see a bowling ball.
Your strawberry clamshells might not be in this refuse pile, but before they get to the end baling, they will probably end up in a refuse pile. Yeah.
Young says later on down the line, the cardboard and paper material are sorted with a sizing screen. The paper rolls over the top because it's flat. But those flimsy plastic berry containers also fold flat.
So it's going to roll over top and it eventually could end up with the paper as well.
She says that's contamination. Until last year, a lot of plastic and paper recycling was sold from facilities like this one to China. But at the beginning of the year, China stopped importing most plastic waste and mixed paper, like junk mail. It has its own trash problems, and China will only accept a prohibitively low amount of contamination in the materials it still takes. That leaves sorting facilities with few options.
If we don't have a market to sell this material to, it essentially isn't a recyclable.
So strawberry containers and yogurt cups have to come out of the waste stream. Even glass has a contamination problem because in a single stream facility, bottle caps and other small items get mixed up with it. Young says Waste Management is trying to get the word out to its customers, those municipalities, that it really only wants paper, cans, and those plastic jars, jugs, and bottles with a narrower top, which they can still sell. Anne Germain is with the National Waste and Recycling Association.
We understand why China is doing this, but the timeline that they set for it was so short, it didn't allow for alternative markets to develop.
Germain says even the alternative markets in Asia, Vietnam and Thailand, are turning away foreign recycling because they're overwhelmed with the surplus. And building similar facilities in the U.S. will take time and investment. She says recycling companies are getting squeezed. The cost of doing business is higher because they have to pay to send more material to the landfill, and they're getting less money for material they can still find a market for. Those costs will eventually be passed on to their customers. Justin Stockdale is Western Regional Director of Pennsylvania Resources Council, a statewide environmental group. He says he doesn't want people to be discouraged by all of this.
It's heartbreaking to say that, well, I buy my thing in that package because I think it's recyclable, and now you're telling me it's not? I've changed my life to support recycling, and now it's all been for naught.
Stockdale says recycling still works, but it's a commodity, not just a way to deal with our trash. He says single-stream recycling, where we put all of the materials in one bin, is easier for people. But it was designed to grow the volume of the material that recyclers actually wanted, like those number 1 and number 2 plastic bottles. So what if we collected the other stuff that's gumming up the works the old-fashioned way? Like we did in the 1980s, by sorting it ourselves and dropping it off at a dedicated facility.
And it may be the glass goes back through drop-off. It may be the cardboard goes back through drop-off.
What about my clamshells?
Maybe the clamshells go back through drop-off. And I think we need to think about this as an opportunity to get it right and to do better.
And as Stockdale reminds me, recycling is only one of the R's. Reduce and reuse are even more critical now, while the world market is in flux. So I could go to the farmer's market with my own container to buy strawberries, or get creative with how to reuse that plastic clamshell. I'm taking suggestions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Kara Holsapple. On the latest episode of our podcast, Trump on Earth, a journalist reports back from the climate summit in Poland.
The Paris Agreement is just a bunch of promises until you have rules that everyone can agree on for how you measure your carbon emissions and how you report those measurements to each other.
In the absence of action on climate change from the Trump administration, cities and states take the lead.
The message that these local leaders are trying to send is at least you can work with the U.S. in good faith. Civil society does not think that climate change is a hoax.
That's on the Trump on Earth podcast at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. In Pennsylvania, 11,000 oil and gas wells have been drilled since the fracking boom came to the state about a decade ago. Many of these wells are in farms and fields where Native American and colonial artifacts are buried. But a loophole in state law lets companies drill at these sites anyway, without first considering their impact on archaeology. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reported about the issue this past summer.
On her family's ridgetop in Washington County, Karen LeBlanc edges her SUV down a newly built dirt road.
This used to be all flat field here. That used to be the view that we had. What we just drove through was a long line of Osage orange trees.
Those trees are gone, and in their place, a construction site, backed up by a big pile of dirt, really a small hill created by bulldozers. This is the land LeBlanc grew up on. This Christmas will mark 100 years since her family has lived here. EQT is developing a well site on a neighboring property, up to 16 shale gas wells extending thousands of feet underground. To access it, EQT built a road through her mother's field.
Their road will go down this way, and over on the other hill is the well pad.
To keep enough water on hand to frack the wells, the company planned to build an impoundment, or artificial pond, right here. But that would put it right next to her mother's house. Her mother is 81 and recently underwent chemotherapy, so LeBlanc wants the company to move the impoundment away from her house. She doesn't think the lease her mother signed 11 years ago gives EQT the right to construct all of this on her property, but the company disagrees. The two sides are fighting over the surface agreement. One prong of LeBlanc's fight is what lies beneath the ground where the impoundment would go. About 80 years ago, so the story goes, her uncle made a discovery there.
He was out exploring, actually plowing for corn in the field, and the plow struck the skull of the Indian bones. They dug it up. They saw what it was. It was viewed by several people.
Her uncle dug up the bones, but eventually reburied them, she says, to prevent looting. In 1981, the state placed the farm on its archaeological survey, a running list of potentially significant sites. But because of a loophole in state law, EQT wasn't required to check that list before it started work. LeBlanc is worried that if it digs up the field, EQT could be destroying a piece of Washington County's past. This bothers her for two reasons. Number one, it turns out one of her ancestors was Cherokee Indian. And the second reason is simple humanity, she says.
If this is your final resting place, why do we need to disturb you? You were there first. You have your right to remain there. They came after. They can move.
To press her argument that the land should be preserved, LeBlanc has enlisted help from local archaeologists. John Nass of California University of Pennsylvania is the archaeologist supervising the dig. He says this is a Native American site that likely dates back hundreds of years.
And this is what we call late prehistoric. So it postdates 1000 AD.
The people who lived here, we don't know what they called themselves. Archaeologists call them the Monongahela tradition.
The site could have been a village or have religious significance. It's unclear. Cassandra Cappy is one of a group of West Virginia University students here today. After sifting through dirt on a screen, she pulls out her cell phone and flips through pictures of objects the team has found in the past few weeks. These include an arrowhead and tools made of stone.
This is prehistoric pottery. It has the marks in it from where they would put like twine or leaves to make the marks. And then on the other side, it's dark black, so we know it was cooked.
In an email, a spokeswoman for EQT said that in response to LeBlanc's, quote, credible claim that the site held human remains, the company hired an archaeologist to survey the field and put a hold on construction there. That evaluation is ongoing, and when it's over, the state will review it and make recommendations about how to mitigate or offset any damage the project would do. But even if the site has a big archaeological significance, nothing in state law prevents EQT from basically doing what it wants here, says John Nass.
For a private property, there's nothing we can really do about it. If you bought property that had a site on it, technically it belongs to you, even if it's recorded with the state. You could bulldoze it away if you wanted to.
The reason is that the strength of the state's historic preservation laws really varies on what you're building. If your project is getting federal permits or grants, say a highway or a pipeline, then your project needs to get some type of archaeological review. In theory, the same is true for projects that require a state permit, like oil and gas wells. But here's the thing. Pennsylvania has a loophole called the 10-acre exemption. If a project is under 10 acres in size, no review is needed, and the vast majority of shale gas wells are under 10 acres in size. That means companies, as is the case with EQT, don't even need to check to see if their well pad is already listed on the state's Register of Historic Sites.
In that instance, even known sites could very well be destroyed or affected.
Ben Ford is an archaeology professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. He says one 2012 study found that in Washington County alone, 60 known sites were damaged or destroyed by gas drilling. Ford thinks state law is allowing the needless destruction of Pennsylvania's cultural and historic heritage. He'd like to see these laws get stronger. Doing away with the 10-acre exemption would be a good start.
What we're usually striving for is to gather enough information and data and know about people in the past while still having construction happen and development happen. So we're trying to strike that balance. And at least in my opinion, the current Pennsylvania state law has disrupted that balance.
If the balance is not tipped back, he says, we could be losing our ability to understand thousands of years of Pennsylvania's past. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
So much about native plants, like which ones are good to eat and where they grow. Well, for centuries, scientists and amateur botanists scoured the country to document and preserve plant species. Their collections were highly prized, like fine art. Earlier this year, State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reported that now there's a new effort to digitize all this information, and it could be a boon for researchers.
On the fifth floor of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, in a cool, windowless room that smells a little pungent, tall metal cabinets store some of the most famous dead plants in the world.
So this is called Grindelia squarosa.
Rick McCourt is the botany curator here, and he reads the notes scribbled around this dried and pressed, pretty yellow flower.
And so it says, prairies in the camp near the old Maha village, that's a Native American village, September 17th, 1804.
members of the Lewis and Clark expedition collected this medicinal flower. This herbarium, like a library for plants, is the oldest in North America. McCourt says it has more than a million dried plants collected by explorers, botanists, and citizen scientists over the past 400 years.
I almost think of it like any collector, like, you know, baseball trading cards. I mean, it was a competitive game to see if you could describe a lot of new species, find a lot of new species, make them valuable to the people you're either working for or your own reputation scientifically. And there were different levels of vanity associated with it, I would say.
These collections are difficult to access. But now, there's a massive effort to photograph and make available online hundreds of thousands of plants housed in about a dozen institutions on the East Coast. It's called the Mid-Atlantic Megalopolis Project. McCourt says hundreds of years of plant data could answer questions about conservation, climate change, and development.
Like, how has the environment changed? What plants occur where? Do they occur someplace differently now than they used to? Are they vanished or gone from an area?
He says it might even raise the possibility of using plant DNA to bring back extinct species.
It's more like a Jurassic Park dream. But DNA is DNA. Who knows? Before 1952, we wouldn't have known what DNA was, right? And much less that you could get it out of museum specimens.
At Muhlenberg College, ecologist Rich Niesenbaum just finished adding its plant collection to the database. He's using it to track down a rare and possibly endangered plant called the flat-stemmed pondweed. But going by the centuries-old handwritten notes isn't easy.
It's a grass, an aquatic grass, growing in Cedar Creek south of Fairview Street.
The notes also mention a quarry, and there's only one in Allentown, so he's pretty confident he knows where to go. We head to Cedar Creek, where thickets of reeds and cattails line the banks.
There's a lot of poison ivy here.
I don't see any grass down in here.
Crowding out everything else are invasive species like Japanese knotweed and stilt grass. One reason why some of these native plants are endangered. But then he does spot the rare grass.
All right, I'm getting in the creek.
Oh, that's refreshing.
Yeah, I think we'll take this back to the lab and take a look at it.
But does it surprise you to even find it here?
Yeah, I'm surprised. I mean, that's exciting because as a plant hunter, right, we spend a lot more time hunting and looking than actually finding if this is indeed the rare plant and it's here right in an urban environment, in an urban setting, that offers a lot of hope.
Niesenbaum says he'll grow it in the lab to make sure it's a match. If so, it will be added to the database, minus the exact location. Because the plant's at risk of being extinct, that will be kept a secret. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. We hope you've enjoyed and learned something from our work in 2018. I know that we have. And we'll be back with a fresh show next week. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.